While all eyes focused this week on Attorney General Jeff Sessions' testimony to the Senate Intelligence Committee in the matters of the Russia investigation and the firing of FBI Director James Comey, another thread was being pulled with the potential to unravel the Trump White House.
Earlier this morning, the state of Maryland and the District of Columbia filed a lawsuit in federal court against the President of the United States.
That's District of Columbia Attorney General Carl Racine. He and the Attorney General of the state of Maryland sued the President under the Constitution's Emoluments Clause, under the premise that foreign money spent at Trump's hotels and resorts in their jurisdictions amount to bribery.
Just one example. The Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, whose government has important business and policy before the President of the United States, has already spent hundreds of thousands of dollars at the Trump International Hotel. And that hotel is but one example of how President Trump's vast global businesses and that empire he has is entangled with foreign and state government interest.
It may or may not be a legal long shot, but if permitted to proceed, the case will almost certainly yield a major result: the release in the discovery phase of the president's long-withheld tax returns. It's a strategy first publicly discussed by legal scholar Jed Sugarman of the Fordham University School of Law, who imagined the lawsuit to come not from the Washington area, but New York State. He joined us back in March. You want state attorneys general where the Trump Organization does business, particularly New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman, to file suit against the company under the Emoluments Clause. But that clause is in the U.S. Constitution. Is it really a matter for individual states?
Every corporation is a creature of state law. To give it a legal fiction of personhood, to have limited liability and extra legal rights like people. But they only have those privileges if they, by law, obey the statutes, obey the law in the country. That's not just state law. Those state statutes also apply to federal law. So state attorneys general, not only in New York, but throughout the country, have the legal power and the legal duty to make sure corporations are following the rule of law, not just state law, but federal law and constitutional law when it comes to anti-corruption.
So you believe that, for example, New York State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman could sue the Trump Organization for acceptance of unlawful emoluments, and by so doing, actually get access to the tax returns by subpoena or by the discovery process?
The first step of discovery to understand what the entanglements with emoluments are, you need to see what the Trump Organization is doing. You would need to know the holdings and the financial structure of the organization. So discovery should be able to get the financial records, the debt records, and the tax returns to enable the judicial system to look at the full picture. So the first step is important in terms of just our basic importance for the public interest of transparency in government.
But you're also interested in the case itself, not just the taxes.
The second step is looking at remedies here, because we first get the transparency to know what's going on, but then we also have to stop emoluments, not just as an archaic 18th century word, as the principle of emoluments, to prevent presidents from being bought and sold, from corruption and foreign entanglements. It's important for us to see how foreign countries are using payments and debts as part of manipulation of the financial picture. Then that also connects to what's going on behind the scenes with this very bizarre behavior of the Trump campaign to now the Trump administration, of being so solicitous and having so much flexibility and generosity to the Putin regime.
So whether or not it wins the case, whether or not it proves a high crime or misdemeanor that the Congress is obliged to deal with, the tax return would be made public.
Exactly.
It's a very ingenious notion. Have you heard from the New York Attorney General's office?
So other journalists have confirmed publicly that the New York Attorney General's office is looking at this proceeding. And several news outlets have looked at this, and I think they are optimistic New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman was terrific in taking the lead against the Trump Corporation in a fairly similar kind of question about fraud. It wasn't just the victims of the fraud with Trump University. It was also Eric Schneiderman who pioneered a public suit. And so if he was willing to take on Trump University, he's certainly willing to take on the Trump Corporation.
When you walk through the halls at school, do people look at you and go, ooh, look at you?
I've never had an experience like this. Usually, like, people sort of tolerate my legal history, 19th century archival navel gazing. But now people walk up and they say, what's happening now? Right? Like, there's nothing like a legal historian suddenly stumbling into finding a way that history can be made relevant.
Jed, thanks very much.
Terrific, Bob.
Law professor Jed Sugarman is the author of Sugar Block.
We won't be able to reckon with corruption in the Trump administration until we get more information. Without Trump's tax returns, how can we learn how entangled his business dealings are? How can we examine a possible smoking gun if it's locked in a safe deposit box? And yet the very fact that we've let so much slip through our grasp shows how far we've moved from the original intent of the founders. Because for them, says Zephyr Teachout, author of Corruption in America, even a snuffbox could be a source of suspicion. Zephyr, welcome to OTM.
It's wonderful to be on.
I think Ben Franklin got ensnared by a snuffbox, didn't he?
Yeah, Franklin had spent some time in France. He was well-loved by the French court. In fact, a lot of people were worried about his loyalties. And then when he was leaving his diplomatic tour, he got this really glamorous, diamond-encrusted snuffbox and a portrait of the French king. And this caused a fair amount of concern and, in fact, was part of the reason that we have in our Constitution the provision called the Emoluments Clause, which prohibits taking gifts, emoluments, as well as offices and titles of nobility from foreign governments.
What's an emolument?
Basically, it's situations in which you're getting paid by foreign governments. I think the easiest way to think about it is something of value. This is one of those rare constitutional clauses that tells you how to read it. It includes this phrase, of any kind whatever. And it's really clear from reading contemporary understandings of the word emoluments that it covered a broad range of situations in which somebody might profit, including business enterprises.
Why were the founders so concerned about corruption? You call it their constant obsession.
These are not naive writers of our Constitution. They've experienced what they perceive as the intense corruption of Britain. And they're all steeped in the story that Rome was torn apart from the inside by corruption. So it's saying we are not going to behave like England or France. We are not going to engage in this culture of having financial relationships between diplomats and governments. It's thumbing its nose at European practice, even though they cared so deeply about developing their own trading relations. The anti-corruption principle was so important to Americans that they were willing to sacrifice some comfort and ease in those relationships to have this anti-corruption principle.
So going back to the snuff boxes.
Yes.
What did they decide? How did they thread that needle of forbidding gifts while existing in a world where this was the general custom?
The practice that developed was to allow Congress to basically bless gifts that came in. Congress would typically say, that's okay, you can keep that snuffbox. Or when John Jay got a horse from the government of Spain, Congress gave Jay permission to keep the horse. This congressional check plays this really important role because it brings the relationship into the daylight. The American public, through Congress, gets to understand what was the nature of the gift. And also then Congress provides this important check if there's anything suspicious, if there's any sense that this might actually lead to either an explicit bribe or to influence that would really undermine the integrity of our decision making.
In your book, you emphasize, and this is really important, that the founders forbid presents, not bribes. No exchange or agreement is required to bring it within the ban.
It's really clear that the framers did not think that corruption was just quid pro quo or explicit exchanges. They really understood how humans can be tempted to betray their loyalties without even really being aware of it. So you need rules that, you know, in law we call these bright line rules or prophylactic rules. Rules that basically say, you just can't do this category of behavior because there's a significant likelihood that if you're in this category of behavior, something wrong is going to happen. So the category is taking gifts or payments. We're not going to necessarily know which ones are influencing, nor are we going to easily discover which ones there might be an agreement around. But we need to ban the category so that we don't risk corruption.
But the founders' anti-corruption vision quickly ran into problems, not in Europe, but on our own shores. I'm thinking of a word that if we were alive 200 years ago, you say we would all have an opinion on. Yazoo.
Yazoo, yes. The Yazoo scandal really occupied the press and the public. Everybody had a position on Yazoo. So Yazoo refers to the lands in western Georgia, and the Georgia legislature gives away millions of acres for pennies on an acre to land speculators.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds bad enough, but it turns out basically all of the lawmakers who'd voted for this land giveaway were getting paid by the land speculators. So they had a direct interest in the sale.
Now, the public threw out every lawmaker who'd voted for the deal, right?
Yes, and that wasn't enough. They actually had a bonfire in the Capitol to burn the bill. And the new lawmakers immediately passed a law saying that law was not a law because it was passed through bribery.
You can burn the bill and you can pass a law, but you don't get rid of the larger issue, at least not in this case.
That's right. The larger issue here is whether a law stops being a law because it was passed in part because of corruption. And this case goes on for years, finally makes it to the Supreme Court. One of my favorite facts about this case is it's the only case I know of where one of the litigators needed time to sober up halfway through oral argument. And basically, the question was, who really owned the land at this point? Was it still held by the people of Georgia? Or was it held by the people who had bought their land ownership from the speculators?
So the speculators that had bribed the Georgian legislators sold the land to people who thought they had a legitimate contract. And basically the court said the contracts superseded the anti-corruption concerns raised by Georgia.
Yeah, that's right. Justice Marshall, who, by the way, had been a land speculator himself, said, it's so sad that corruption has crept into our young republic, but it's sort of beyond the scope of this court to pass judgment on what was a fundamentally corrupt contract and what was not. And the reason I find this episode really interesting is in part because it shows the awkward relationship between law and corruption and how hard it is for courts to decide particular instances of corruption.
How did the conception of corruption, not in the legal sphere, but in the public imagination, shift over time?
You know, I actually think that the understanding of corruption in the public imagination has stayed fairly constant, except for some elites who sometimes run away with an idea that if it's not against the law, it's not corrupt. Mark Twain actually talks about this in his novel, The Gilded Age. One of the stories that you see is the story of two languages, the language of the people and the language of the people who go to Washington, D.C., who understand corruption in a totally different way and are much more dismissive of corruption. But really until the 1970s, court after court after court understood that protecting against corruption inside our country was one of the jobs of our country, and was one of the greatest threats to our country. And then you see that kind of drop away really in the 1970s.
So take us there. What happened?
So in 1976, the Supreme Court decided a really important case, Buckley versus Vallejo, and struck down some campaign finance laws and set up a two-step process that we've really been living inside ever since. The first step is to ask, when there is a campaign finance rule, does that campaign finance rule infringe on freedom of speech? And the second step is to say, if it does it, however, serve an anti-corruption interest? Suddenly, it really matters what corruption means. Because if corruption just means explicit quid pro quo, then a lot of what we think of as anti-corruption laws are going to get struck down.
So back in the days of the founders, they recognized that something could be corrupt even if it wasn't illegal. Now you have to find an explicit exchange of something for something, a quid pro quo, and only a complete boob would get caught doing that. So much of this exchange is either behind closed doors or through intermediaries or is just assumed. So the kind of ambiguity in human nature, the indirect influence that the founder saw as corruption is now, strictly speaking, only if you have sold your office or your vote.
No, that's right. And the loss is enormous. It's certainly a loss of a central part of our heritage as a country. We were founded on an anti-corruption passion, but it was also incredible wisdom. It was an understanding that corruption is this very serious threat to self-government. And we've certainly felt the effects. We felt the effects in the super PACs that have arisen since Citizens United. And we as citizens are left with fewer and fewer tools to fight corruption.
Which brings us to now. You're currently working on behalf of a group called Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, or CREW, trying to revive those long-lost anti-corruption traditions by suing Donald Trump for violating the Emoluments Clause. What makes you believe that that could possibly work, especially without his tax returns, and especially without standing?
There's a lot of really hard, complicated, interesting corruption law questions. Donald Trump violating the Emoluments Clause is not one of them. It is really straightforward that he is violating the Constitution and began violating it on the day he took office.
Why?
Well, there's four different ways in which he's basically getting things of value from foreign governments. The first is through the Trump Tower in New York City. The Chinese government, through the Industrial and Commercial Bank of China, is one of the largest tenants in Trump Tower. So we basically have the Chinese government putting payments into Donald Trump's pockets. The second flow of emoluments, dignitaries from foreign governments staying in Trump hotels. The third is through The Apprentice and The New Celebrity Apprentice in two countries at least. The payments for royalties around The Apprentice come from government-owned entities. And then the fourth area is all the Trump Organization developments around the world require government action, whether in Turkey or India or China. And the governments are in a position to make our president richer or poorer. I think the important thing to understand is that the Emoluments Clause is a bright line rule. It's like a speed limit. If the speed limit is 55 and someone's going 68, they don't get to turn to the cop and say, well, the roads were dry and nobody else was around. Therefore, it isn't a violation. This is a safety rule, right? If a federal officer is taking payments from foreign governments, the federal officer doesn't get to turn around and say, oh, well, in this particular instance, I wasn't getting influenced. It doesn't matter. You violated the rule.
Well, let me ask you this. The clause says that Congress has to approve, right?
That's right.
So if Trump wanted this to go away, couldn't he just get the Congress, which is pretty supine these days, to just approve?
Yeah, it's quite striking that he hasn't gone to Congress to ask for their approval. To do that, he would have to reveal the full extent of the nature of the payments. Congress could either accept and say, you can keep those, or reject and say, you can't keep those. It's certainly a direction that Trump could be undertaking, but instead he's just violating the Constitution every day.
Zephyr, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Zephyr Teachout is a law professor at Fordham University and author of the book, Corruption in America.
Thanks for listening to this On the Media podcast extra. Hey, while I have you here, have you become a member of the OTM community? We're asking our listeners to contribute $7 a month, and in return, you'll get a copy of Brooke's new book, The Trouble with Reality. And you'll also get the satisfaction of being a part of, as someone famous recently put it, this thing we have. See you at the end of the week with the big show. And meantime, thanks.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.